A presidential threat in all caps today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump writes a threatening tweet in uppercase warning Iran not to threaten the U.S. Some see it as part of the Trump team's regime change strategy toward Iran. This Iranian-American is skeptical.
There's a significant leap of faith to think that Donald Trump, Mike Pompeo, and John Bolton are the answers to Iran's problems.
Meanwhile, let's not forget so quickly about Russia.
We have a situation where the president really seems to be conducting his own Russia policy, which isn't really in sync with the Russia policy of his government.
Plus, remembering food critic Jonathan Gold and the impact he had on his beloved Los Angeles.
He sort of was always optimistically trying to bridge the disparate communities of L.A. through the foods.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. A happy Monday to you, and the week begins once again with comments from President Trump. In all capital letters to boot, which takes us back, psychically anyway, to North Korea. But this time, it's Iran that's the focus of Trump's shouting tweet. Meanwhile, the Putin paint from last Monday in Helsinki isn't anywhere near dry, not to mention the rhetorical contradictions about what was and wasn't said. We're going to dive into all of this, Iran, Trump's tweet, and let's start with Mr. Putin. Susan Glasser writes a weekly column for The New Yorker about Donald Trump's Washington. It's been a week, Susan, since Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin met in Helsinki, and there's a lot we don't know. And since 2 hours of that meeting was off the record, there's a lot we may never know. What has Putin said about the summit?
Well, you know, it's really striking, actually, that the Russians have come out and given a lot more details of what they say was agreed upon between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin at the summit. The American government has been remarkably silent. And in fact, just this morning, you had Sarah Sanders asked, well, are we ever going to hear the U.S. government side of what was happening in that private meeting? She said, oh, we've addressed it last week. But in reality, the Russians have come out and said, as President Putin put it, that important verbal agreements were made with Donald Trump. Americans have not confirmed this. But basically, they appear to have discussed possible Russian proposals on everything from Syria to Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, those are some pretty big proposals. Reconstruction of war-torn Syria, cooperation on nuclear weapons and terrorism. What do American diplomats know about these agreements that Putin is now kind of shaping the narrative around?
Well, you know, that's the part that was so striking to me as someone who's covered Russia for the last couple decades on and off. When I asked veteran diplomats, including a sitting U.S. ambassador in Europe whose job requires him to know what the heck is going on with Russia, completely in the dark was the words that came back. We have a situation where the president really seems to be conducting his own Russia policy, which isn't really in sync with the Russia policy of his government.
Are there any conclusions we can draw about what happened in Helsinki if you just read between the lines?
Both the public optics and the behavior since then suggest that President Trump genuinely was extremely solicitous of Vladimir Putin, non-confrontational, unwilling to hold the line on issues like sanctions. We don't know why President Trump did those things, but it does appear that he's taken a much more accommodationist tone with President Putin. What I'm struck by is the lectures we've been hearing for the last year and a half from those who work for President Trump saying, listen, don't pay attention to the tweets, don't pay attention to the rhetoric, look at the policy on Russia, it's really tough, we're tougher than Obama. At times you've heard that line from the president himself, and yet it stands in pretty stark variance with both his pursuit of these summits with Vladimir Putin and his behavior in them. And so I feel like at least it puts out there in the open for all to see that there is an enormous conflict inside the government on Russia.
Yeah, and I would imagine there's a lot of room for misunderstanding and therefore even conflict outside this government.
That's exactly right. I mean, again, especially when you are ostensibly the leader of a complicated multi-nation alliance whose main concern in recent years has been renewed Russian aggression towards its neighbors and revisionism of the post-Cold War, post-World War II borders that it had agreed to. Remember, he came out of a NATO summit where he basically bashed leaders of the NATO countries and was questioning that partnership while also praising President Putin. And how can you maintain a consistent and unified front as an alliance if the leader of your alliance doesn't seem to be on board with those policies? The communication, the disorganization, I think it's all reflective of a genuine and serious dispute inside the Trump government that's having a ripple effect outside of it as well.
Yeah, so contradictions upon contradictions. Yesterday, as you know, Trump tweeted a direct threat at Iran. Do you think this is a distraction, a way to shift focus away from all this news about Russia and Putin?
Well, look, I can't begin to speak to the intent behind something like that, but obviously that might be one of the hoped for consequences. But, you know, it's pretty disconcerting, isn't it, to live in this Trump news cycle. One can't even go to bed on a Sunday night and wake up in the morning to what appears to be an all caps threat of nuclear war with the Iranians. So, you know, it's definitely disconcerting. And obviously it's not very diplomatic.
I mean, we're kind of chuckling about it, but what a president says on an official Twitter account, on an official White House stationery, it's important.
That's exactly right. It's no laughing matter. And frankly, even if the consequence here is not to actually launch us to armed conflict with the Iranians, the consequence is to further devalue the word of the president of the United States. To me, that is an own goal in international diplomacy, to undermine what had been one of the most significant assets that the United States had in the world, which was the strength and credibility and power behind the words of the president of the United States. I think those no longer hold the power that they used to as a result of the almost promiscuous use of his Twitter feed.
Susan Glasser writes a weekly column for The New Yorker about Donald Trump's Washington. Thanks for being with us, as always.
Thanks for having me.
The president's tweet about Iran leads to a big question. What is the current U.S. strategy on Iran? It's actually not so clear at this point. We'll have more about that on the show later, but we did get a glimpse of the Trump administration's thinking over the weekend.
The goal of our efforts is to one day see Iranians in Iran enjoying the same quality of life that Iranians in America enjoy.
That was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo yesterday at the Ronald Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California. He was speaking in front of what's been described as a largely Iranian-American audience at an event called Supporting Iranian Voices. And the rest of Pompeo's remarks were very critical of Iran's leadership. Trita Parsi is a president of the National Iranian American Council. So your group, Trita, was not in attendance at the Reagan Library. Why not?
Well, first of all, we were not invited. But had we been invited, we would not have attended anyways, because this was not a dialogue. This was an effort by the Trump administration to give the impression that the Iranian American community, by and large, support his very belligerent policy. And reality is that the majority of Iranian Americans do not.
Are you saying that the audience for the Mike Pompeo talk was basically the deck was stacked? I mean, who were those Iranian Americans that were there?
I'm afraid that even though many of them were there out of curiosity, they certainly didn't believe that attending would be tantamount to supporting what Pompeo was saying. But I think many of them were used to come across as support for the administration. This is reminding me very much of what happened during the Bush years, when the Bush administration run up to the war in Iraq and in their effort to try to convince the American public to support the invasion, were parading Iraqis and Iraqi Americans on TV begging the United States to bomb Iraq. I think most people in the Iranian American community do not want to play that role for the Trump administration.
So let's listen to a little bit more from Secretary Pompeo's speech yesterday at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, and then I want to get your reaction to this.
I recognize the Iranian diaspora is diverse, but I think everyone can agree that the regime in Iran has been a nightmare for the Iranian people. And it's important that your unity on that point is not diminished by differences elsewhere. To our Iranian American and to our Iranian American friends, tonight I want to tell you that the Trump administration dreams the same dreams for the people of Iran as you do. And through our labors and God's providence, that day will come true.
So, Trita Parsi, what's your reaction to that? Like, as an Iranian-American, do you agree that Iran's leadership has been a nightmare for the Iranian people?
Oh, I think a vast majority of our community would be very, very much in agreement that the Iranian government has been extremely bad for the country as a whole, and they are very much yearning for democratic change. The vast majority would also agree that the democratic change has to come from inside and not from the United States. And perhaps most importantly, despite the very, very intense frustrations that exist right now, mindful of the political repression of the Iranian government, of its corruption, etc., there's a significant leap of faith to be frustrated about that and then think that Donald Trump, Mike Pompeo, and John Bolton are the answers to Iran's problems. That's a leap of faith that is just simply too sizable for most people to take.
When you hear President Rouhani of Iran say and warning the U.S., do not play with the lion's tail or else you will regret it, and war with Iran would be the mother of all wars, what's your reaction?
I think it's extremely unfortunate. This type of rhetoric is not what's needed in any way, shape, or form. What is needed right now is diplomacy, and the parties need to go back to the table. But we can't at the same time ignore that it was Donald Trump that walked out of this nuclear deal and started violating it, not the Iranians. It is Donald Trump that has initiated this escalation that we're now seeing reach very dangerous levels.
If many Iranian Americans want change to come, but they want it to come from inside Iran as opposed to, you know, regime change from outside, did many of them see the Iran nuclear deal as just prolonging the status quo with the Revolutionary Guard still in these strong positions where they, as Pompeo rightly said, they operate as a kind of government mafia enriching themselves?
The vast majority of Iranian Americans wanted to see the nuclear deal partly because they believe that reduced tensions and opening up Iran to the outside world is the best way of supporting the people inside of Iran that are pushing for democratic change. The more tensions we have, the more pressure, the more economic sanctions we have, the first people that suffer from that are ordinary people, not the regime itself.
You know, despite Dick Cheney and John Bolton's saber-rattling during the Bush administration, we even heard about the specter of a bombing war. None of that happened. How concerned are you that that could be the outcome of what we're hearing right now?
It's very interesting that it didn't happen because at the end of the day, even President Bush himself rejected the pressure from Israel and Saudi Arabia to take military action because he understood how dangerous that was. I am worried that the current president doesn't fully grasp these things and he's chased out the people in his administration that were courageous enough to speak out, were willing to counter the president in internal meetings. Right now, you have increasingly a group of people around Trump that are just yes men and that are pushing for the very same type of confrontation as the Israelis and the Saudis are. And particularly if Secretary of Defense Mattis ends up leaving the administration, which is rumored now, then you have none of the type of internal balancing inside the administration that could cause the administration to think twice about things of this nature.
That's Trita Parsi. He's president of the National Iranian American Council. He's also author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Here's a preview of a story we're working on for tomorrow's show. We take you back decades to the late 1970s, after the Vietnam War. Refugees, boat people, were settling on a Pacific island that was completely deserted. Our story is about a 16-year-old Vietnamese girl. She and her younger siblings were among the first to relocate to this remote Indonesian island.
So when she arrived, there was pretty much nothing there. There were no people, no buildings. They were on their own.
Help would eventually arrive, but it would take months, so the refugees learned to survive.
And they found a creek, and people learned how to fish. They hunted lizards. They even learned how to pelt bats with slingshots.
How one young survivor kept her siblings alive on Kuku Island. Their story coming up tomorrow. Jonathan Gold made Angelinos realize they could get a top-notch meal from a taco truck and change their relationship to Los Angeles in the process. We remember Jonathan Gold later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. With North Korea in the headlines lately, we decided to reach into the archives of our partners at the BBC World Service. The fighting in Korea ended in 1953, although technically the war never ended. At the time, David Hawkins was an American soldier who'd been captured by Chinese troops. They offered Hawkins a choice: go home to America or go live in communist China. He chose the latter. Hawkins shared a story with the BBC's Chloe Hajimathayu.
It's autumn 1953, and Pathé News is reporting on an unprecedented repatriation of prisoners of war.
In Korea, Operation Comeback begins. 22,500 Chinese and North Korean troops take the winding road to freedom. It is their own wish that they should not return to their homelands, stoutly refusing to live under communist rule again. The system of allowing prisoners to choose whichever country they wish resulted in only 21 Americans and one British Marine electing not to return home.
I don't think it ever occurred to the U.S. or the Army that there would be GIs who would choose to go someplace else other than their home country. My reasoning was they really have embraced socialism, so let me see what it's like. I'll check it out.
After fighting in a war that set the West against communist forces, David Hawkins and 20 other GIs made the astounding decision to check out life in a country both feared and loathed by their nation.
We never really talked about it that much among ourselves, but I can tell you that we were pretty much apolitical. I know I was. They said, we don't care if you're political or not. You can be just what they call a progressive worker. And I'm going, that's me. I'm a progressive worker. I never thought of the consequences.
David was only 17 when he was first sent to the front lines in Korea. There, the United Nations and American troops were defending South Korea against the Chinese, who, with the backing of the Soviet Union, were supporting the North Korean aggressors. Within a few months of his arrival, David was injured.
When I woke up, it was daylight, and I was in a cave, which turned out to be a Chinese field hospital. And this doctor handed me a little piece of shrapnel that he had taken out of my leg and says, we are your friends, we won't hurt you. They took me to a clearing camp called Puchin. We called it Death Valley.
Why did you call it that?
There was no heat, with temperatures exceeding 42 below zero. Myself and the others that were with me, we all had contracted frostbitten feet and hands, all of us. I lost a little toe on my left foot and all the ends of my toes. We were all covered with lice. All of us had dysentery. We were only there a week or two before people actually started dying. The Chinese would come to the door and he would count the number of people in the room. And then shortly afterwards, there would be a big wooden bowl of soupy sorghum. We had a serving of that once a day. Well, we soon learned, because it was so cold and everything, that you didn't have to worry about decomposition. Nobody was smelling. So we hit on the idea that if somebody died, we'd just prop him up with his back against the wall. And then when the guy came to count, we would get that ration. That was kind of the way we got extra food. We were on a very thin line of survival there. They had captured probably better than 7,000 American servicemen. And within the first 3 months, over 2,000 of those people had died. I was just 17. I turned 17 on the way to Korea. So maybe that youth let me survive. I don't know.
After several months, things began to improve for David and his fellow soldiers. They were moved to another camp where the conditions were far better. This would be his home for almost 3 years.
When we first got back and they got us all cleaned up and kind of squared away, they started the indoctrination program. For the first almost year that we were there, we've spent most of the day was in indoctrination. They had built up on the hills by headquarters this like a theater with wooden benches. And they would lecture us for 6 or 7 hours a day on the evils of capitalism and the great things about Marx, Engels, Marxism and political science and et cetera, et cetera.
Did it have any effect on you?
No, it didn't work. We would we'd listen to them and then we'd have to go back to our squads and we were supposed to talk about the evils of capitalism and the unjust war in Korea. And when we got back to the squads, we would all sit around in circles and talk about cars and women and that sort of thing like GIs do.
What was the relationship like between the prisoners and the guards?
They didn't call us prisoners. They called us students. We were the result of what they had determined to be the lenient treatment policy toward prisoners of war. They treated us very civilly.
Were you surprised by that?
Well, absolutely. You know, I'm like everybody else. You hear stories about how prisoners of war were treated, and the Chinese had a reputation of being great at torture. So yeah, we were surprised that, oh my God, at first we were expecting the worst, and when they started treating us well, I said, well, that's great. I'm going to appreciate that.
In fact, David was so impressed by the way the Chinese treated him, he decided to return with them to Beijing, where he enrolled at the university to study the language.
Now, when I got out of college, what I did then was that I applied for and received a commercial driver's license from the Chinese. And I went to a place called Wuhan, and I drove a big 10-ton Czechoslovakian dump truck for this factory. And I was the only foreigner in the whole city. People were not shy. They would say, well, where are you from? And I'd say, well, guess. And then they'd go through the big routine and tell them, no, I'm an American. And they wouldn't believe me. We were like heroes. They wanted to know what your lifestyle was like and where you lived. It was kind of like meeting some kind of a celebrity of some kind.
Into Hong Kong walked three former American soldiers who chose communism 2 years ago in Korea, but now have had enough. Escorted by British officials, the dishonorably discharged GIs are considered prohibited immigrants, but America agrees to accept them as citizens.
Back in the USA, the soldiers who turned their backs on their country had been labeled turncoats and traitors. Pathé News covered the first Americans who began drifting home from China.
Otho Bell, 24, says he attempted suicide in communist China. William Cowart, 23, describes communist farm life as hell. Although expecting prosecution, they all prefer America and an uncertain fate.
But after 3 years in China, David was ready to face his own uncertain fate back home.
I didn't think too much about the consequences, but I thought it was time to leave that regime. And that was, I told the Chinese that I thought I was ready to come home. And a week later, I was on my way out. That was the only time I was really nervous, was when I got back to the States.
Well, the military had discharged you, so you didn't face any legal issues. But how did it feel to be back?
My hardest part was that I had become China, what we call China-ized. Chinese called Chunglehuada. My thought processes and everything were in Chinese. And the fact that I was so young when I first came back, when I was in China, I'm dealing with people older than I, much more sophisticated politically, and I found it very shallow, and I couldn't deal with people on that level when I came back. I had a hard time for the first couple of years that I was back until it finally began to acclimate. I started getting a lot of people calling me, and colleges invited me to lecture at their schools. And that was very surprising that there was no animosity.
Do you have any regrets about what you did?
No, I never had regrets. No. You know, the one big thing that I learned about going to China was how lucky we are here in the United States. The lifestyle that we have, our government's not perfect, but I think it's one of the best in the world. So I learned so much. I learned to be a better American. If nothing else, I'm a real patriot.
That incredible story from the BBC's archives. Korean War vet David Hawkins spoke with Chloe Hajimatheu in 2012. You're listening to The World.
Support for this podcast comes from LegalZoom. Becoming a successful business owner doesn't just happen. It takes hard work, and you really can't afford to let anything get in your way. So when it comes to all the details and regulations, you need someone that has your back. That someone is LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom's mission is to help all Americans confidently and confidently navigate the legal system. They put together a network of independent attorneys, licensed in every state, available to answer your questions and provide legal advice for your business without billing by the hour, since LegalZoom is not a law firm. But over a million people have trusted LegalZoom for business formation and help, because as a business owner, you have enough to worry about without getting bogged down with legal stuff. For that, there's LegalZoom. Hurry to LegalZoom.com/world for special savings. That's LegalZoom.com/world. LegalZoom, where life meets legal.
I'm Marco Werman. Mesut Özil won a World Cup with the German national soccer team back in 2014. The son of Turkish immigrants was a hero. 4 years later, Özil says it's a different picture.
One of the most striking comments he made was, "When we win, I'm a German. When we lose, I'm an immigrant."
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC, World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We've been talking today on the show about the war of words between Iran and the Trump administration over the last 24 hours. Washington is clearly ratcheting up the pressure on Tehran, but to what end?
It's Iran's strategy is regime change, but the way the administration is phrasing it is behavior change.
That's Ali Vaez, director of the Iran Project at the International Crisis Group in Washington.
The Trump White House says that it wants Iran to change its behavior, but the scale and scope of behavior change really amounts to regime change, because if the Iranians are to agree to all the demands that the administration has for Iran changing not only its regional behavior, but also its domestic policy, its nuclear policy, its ballistic missile program, it really amounts to having a different regime in Tehran.
Well, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and National Security Advisor John Bolton are well-known hawks when it comes to Iran. Here's John Bolton speaking to a group of Iranian exiles in Washington last summer.
The behavior and the objectives of the regime are not going to change, and therefore the only solution is to change the regime itself. And that's why before 2019, we here will celebrate in Tehran. Thank you very much.
Now, we need to point out that was John Bolton speaking several months before he became Trump's national security advisor. But does he still think like that, Ali Vaez?
There is no evidence that he doesn't. There are many in this national security team who have repeatedly said that they don't believe that the Iranian system is capable of changing its behavior. So their preferred option is regime change.
And that time frame Bolton mentioned right there at the end, next year in Tehran. I mean, what's he saying with that? Because it's got echoes of liberation of enslaved people and next year in Jerusalem kind of thing.
Yes, next year, February 2019, marks the 40th anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran. And basically, Bolton is saying before the regime reaches its 40th anniversary, it will be toppled. And that's one reason that the administration has pursued a very aggressive sanctions policy with the hope of reducing Iran's oil exports to zero by November 2018, again, with the hope of collapsing the Iranian economy and with it unraveling the Islamic Republic. But, you know, this is the Iranian regime is a system that has been under sanctions for more than four decades. So it knows how to circumvent them. It knows how to survive. And for them, survival is victory.
If you turn then to Trump's military option, I mean, his military bluster on North Korea turned out to be empty threats in the face of military realities on the ground. What are the military options when it comes to Iran for the U.S.?
Look, the only way that the U.S. can topple the Iranian regime is to invade Iran. But Iran is three times the size of Iraq and three times the population of Iraq. So, you know, for those who liked the Iraq war or Afghanistan war, they're going to love the war with Iran, because I think those two wars compared with a war with Iran would be like a cakewalk. And the reality is neither the Trump administration nor I think any other administration could realistically consider invading Iran. So the other option is a limited military clash that would not topple the regime, but would allow it to militarize and securitize the domestic sphere. And in fact, it would allow it to crush dissent and add to its shelf life. It would consolidate the most hardline elements of the Islamic Republic, and it would push Iran to lash out in the region.
It sounds like, from what you're saying, the Trump administration has very few paths to follow here.
Look, I think the administration will pursue a pressure strategy and will declare victory one way or another. It would say that pressure has weakened the Iranian economy and has forced Iran to be more internally focused, and as a result of that is not interfering in the region as much as before. But the reality is that the objective, which is to change Iran's behavior or its regime, is not going to be met by this purely pressure-centered strategy.
Ali Vaez at the International Crisis Group in Washington, thank you.
My pleasure.
Mesut Özil is a star soccer player for Germany's national team, but he has announced he's resigning. Özil is not past his prime. He's not on the injured list. He's leaving the team because, as he wrote on Twitter, he felt attacked by Germans because of his Turkish heritage. This summer, prior to the World Cup, Özil had a photo taken of himself standing next to Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey. He explained in his tweet that the photo was showing respect for his roots. But some German politicians who saw the picture questioned Özil's loyalty to Germany and to Germany's democratic values. Some media outlets even went so far as to blame Özil for Germany's loss in the World Cup.
What's effectively happened is it's a bit of a perfect storm.
Kevin Hatchard is a TV commentator for Germany's Bundesliga.
You've got a situation where Germany massively underperformed. Nobody expected them to fail to get out of the group stage, but they were very poor in all three of their games at the World Cup. What happened was a lot of people drew parallels between the incident that had happened and the problems that Germany were experiencing. They felt that the row about the Erdogan photos had carried over, had affected morale, and therefore that was a detrimental factor. And also that Özil hadn't played particularly well. So he's become something of a scapegoat. Oliver Bierhoff, who's the team manager, he said that maybe they should have considered leaving Özil out of the squad entirely. And when he said that, after they crashed out of the tournament, what that effectively did was it singled Özil out And he's had some effectively racist abuse from far-right groups, including the AfD, Alternative for Deutschland, who are a right-wing, far-right group in the German parliament. So it's a very messy situation, and Özil feels that the response to what he did has been disproportionate, and that's why he's walking away. One of the most striking comments he made was, "When we win, I'm a German. When we lose, I'm an immigrant."
And yeah, do you think that's a fair criticism?
I think if you look at the reaction that there has been since the World Cup, I think you'd have to say there is some merit in that, because I think the questioning of his loyalty has been frankly outrageous. This is a guy who's been somebody who's represented his country for a long, long time, somebody who has 92 senior caps for Germany, somebody who has really given a lot to the German game. And for him to have been questioned in the way that he's been questioned, for his loyalty to have been impugned in the way that it has, I think is outrageous. And I can totally understand why he feels he has to walk away at this stage. It's a real tragedy for German football, because he's been a titan for German football in the last few years. And, you know, he's received awards reflecting what he's done for multiculturalism. And I think it's a great, great shame that he's been effectively hounded out in this way.
So zoom out a bit, if you would, Kevin. What does it say kind of about the larger picture about identity politics and soccer in Europe right now?
It does. You know, politics do bleed into football. Absolutely. And I think it's impossible to separate the two, because you've got a guy that was very much held up as a great example of integration and a great example of somebody who, as he puts it, has two hearts, if you like, one German, one Turkish. And people will wonder if this walking away that Özil is doing from the national team is a symbol for something greater that's happening in Germany right now. And you just wonder whether it will heighten tensions. It's a very, very disappointing and worrying situation.
Özil was born in Germany. I mean, he's the son of immigrants, but he himself is not an immigrant. Do you think he's kind of become a proxy for Merkel's immigration policies for people who don't like him?
I think what's happened is I go back again to his comment that when we win, I'm a German, and when we lose, I'm an immigrant. Mm-hmm. And that's been, you know, that kind of comment has been made by other people in other nationalities. If you look at Romelu Lukaku, the Belgian striker, he has said, when we do well and when I do well, I'm a Belgian striker. When I don't do so well or the team is struggling, I'm the Belgian striker of Congolese descent. Karim Benzema, when he was playing for France, made similar comments. You know, when it's going well, I'm French. When it's not going well, I'm an Arab. And there is clearly an issue here with players of dual nationality, which, you know, reflects tensions and problems in society as a whole. So, yeah, I think you do look at what's happening with Özil right now, and it's impossible not to widen out that debate, if you like.
Kevin Hatchard, a TV commentator for Germany's Bundesliga. Thanks very much for your time and telling us about this.
Thanks a lot.
The overall number of migrants heading to Europe has come down in the past couple of years, but people are still coming and the risks remain high. Not surprisingly, that's especially true for women. The UN estimates that as many as 80% of Nigerian women who arrive in Italy by sea could be victims of sex trafficking. They are promised good jobs in Europe, but once they arrive, they're forced to work as prostitutes to pay off the cost of their journey. Once they do that, many of them ultimately go back to Nigeria. Reporter Krista Marr met one woman who made the return journey, and Krista went to see her at her home outside of Lagos.
It's still mid-morning here on the outskirts of Lagos, but it's hot, and Joy has had enough.
That's my house, dear.
She points to an unfinished house on a dirt plot with no roof and only a couple of windows and doors.
See, I'm leaving. I'm tired. I don't like it.
Joy and her husband have been trying for years to scrape the money together to finish their small home.
This is where we live. This is a room where we sleep.
They show me around the cinder block shell and point out a carefully stacked pile of wood on the dirt floor and what they hoped would be the dining room.
Dining. This is a dining.
This is a dining parlor.
Right now you're using this as a place to cook.
Yeah.
Back in 2005, when she was 22, Joy left her husband and two young children and flew to Italy. She was traveling illegally on another person's passport. A family friend had arranged her passage, promising a good job as a nanny on the other side.
And when they told me there's work in Italy, so I was happy to go there to work so that I can feed my family.
But once Joy got to Italy, she found herself trapped in a sex work.
It was prostitute they introduced me to.
Joy is a pseudonym. She asked us not to use her real name because of the stigma surrounding prostitution. For 3 years, Joy worked on the streets of Parma to buy back her freedom. She says she was beaten up by the cops and jailed for not having legal papers. One time, when she refused to get into a man's car, he slashed her with a knife. She still has a nasty scar across one cheek.
Stabbed me with knife on my face, and this is the...
That's what that scar is from?
Yeah.
Joy ultimately managed to pay off her traffickers in Parma, but she didn't have a visa to live or work in Italy, so she sought help from Caritas, an NGO that helps trafficking victims. Joy says she made friends there and started to enjoy life in Italy.
I want to stay in Italy and get a good role so I can invite my children.
She wanted to get a job and bring her children over, but the immigration papers never came through. She couldn't earn money and had to stay inside all day to avoid the police. Eventually, Joy got sick of waiting, and she missed her family. She says Caritas helped her get a plane ticket to go home. Joy returned to Lagos, the sprawling megacity not far from where she grew up, in Edo State. At first, Joy stayed in a Catholic shelter run by a nun in Lagos. Sister Patricia has been helping trafficking victims since the late 90s.
We go to the airport, wait for them, meet them, bring them back to the shelter. But we assure them that the rest of us here, we are surviving.
Joy and I didn't talk about why she didn't go immediately back to her husband and kids. But Sister Antonia, another nun I spoke with who works with trafficking victims, explains why some may hesitate to go back to their families.
They may not be accepted warmly. Maybe they didn't bring enough money when they are coming. So some of the family members, they may react negatively to them.
These women often support their families, so their return can mean the end of a family income. In the Lagos shelter, Sister Patricia gave Joy seed money to start a small shop and helped her get back in contact with her mother in Edo State.
My name is Comfort Obano. I'm from Edo State.
Comfort says she didn't know what her daughter was doing in Italy. She says, I thought my daughter was going to be doing cleaning. If it was a good job, it would have been okay. But being a prostitute is a very bad job.
But that job is a rough job.
Comfort says she told her daughter to come home. But here's the thing. Even though Joy is happy to be with her family again, she wishes she were still in Italy. She says she didn't know what things would be like in Nigeria now, how hard it is to scrape by.
But now that I know, it's like, I don't know. Me and my family, I want to leave.
The little shop Joy opened with the startup money from Sister Patricia never got off the ground, and her husband has been sick and out of work. She's so determined to get out of Nigeria again, she says she would risk making the ground trip through Libya, despite the real dangers she knows migrants face there, including sexual assault and even being sold into slavery.
This is me.
In a suitcase, Joy keeps a stack of photos from Italy. She flips through a few, pointing to pictures of herself mugging for the camera.
These are my friends.
It looks like you're having fun there.
Yes, I look happy. Much more happy.
If she does find a way to get back to Italy, Joy is clear about some things. She won't make the trip back on her own this time.
Me and my family, not alone.
And she won't work as a prostitute.
No. I vow in my life, I'll never do that again. Not again, never.
For the World, Chris Tamar, Lagos, Nigeria.
Jonathan Gold, the Los Angeles Times food critic who redefined food writing in the United States, died on Saturday at the age of 57. Gold was the first food critic to win the Pulitzer Prize for criticism. But for Gold, writing about food wasn't about recognition or acclaim. It was about finding the culinary diamond in the rough. For Gold, shining a light on a truck selling authentic mouthwatering tacos took precedence over a Michelin-starred bistro. Danielle Hernandez is the editor of L.A. Taco, and he joined us to talk about the legacy of Jonathan Gold. You met Jonathan Gold. Tell us who he was. What was he all about?
Well, Jonathan Gold was kind of this L.A. creature, born and bred here in Los Angeles. He grew up, you know, in a traditional Jewish L.A. home, was a cellist, and then kind of just became an L.A. punk and an L.A. music critic and writer, firstly at the L.A. Weekly while he was still at UCLA. And then he turned to food and he really, I think, began to capture the essence of all of the different cultures and cuisines that mix in Los Angeles in a very groundbreaking way. And I think that we are now really considering what his influence and reach really is and what that really means for the whole of the city.
And not to overstate the matter, but how far are people going to say what he meant to the city?
Well, even I've just been thinking about it, and even just this morning, I'm thinking, you know, did Jonathan Gold invent the concept of the taco truck and the taco stand as a legitimate sort of subject of consideration, not just in the mainstream press and in the alternative press, but in the way we understand one another? And I dare say that I think he did. In addition to that, I mean, just all of the ways that he was able to identify the complexities of, let's say, the various regional cuisines of Mexico, the various regional cuisines of Thailand, the various regional cuisines of China, and so on. All of that and how it manifested and represented in Los Angeles a conduit and a way for us to interact and understand us ourselves a little bit better, especially in the wake of the 1992 LA riots, for example, and in many ways geographically that it is difficult to get to know other parts of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I think through that, he was able to really lay down a template for the kind of food writing I think that has become the norm or the standard today.
How did Jonathan Gold become a food critic? And did that happen after the 92 LA riots?
No, it happened before, as far as I understand, in the 80s is when he started sort of dipping into food at the Weekly. You know, the LA Weekly back in the 1980s, along with things like the Village Voice and the San Francisco Bay Guardian, were very important platforms. As I understand it, Jonathan sort of took to the city in a very optimistic and open way, and in the kind of curious way that really any good journalist who tackles any subject is able to activate, which is that you're always discovering something new, but you always are relearning about the sort of fundamentals or the basics of your topic or your subject over and over. And I think Jonathan achieved that in his work.
It's interesting when you were talking about weekly newspapers like the Village Voice and LA Weekly that they were also kind of this conduit to the music scene. And he wrote about music, Jonathan Gold did, hip hop in particular, prior to becoming a food critic. Do you think there's an important relationship there?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I just think it shows what a very smart journalist and writer he was. You know, he's either credited or blamed with coining the term gangster rap. He was the first to really put sort of a razor sharp, let's say, legitimizing focus on people like Snoop Dogg, NWA, those figures in sort of West Coast rap. I think it'd be very natural for someone who's so good as a music writer to also be good as a food critic. I think it's very funny, and I think it's very inspiring that, you know, this guy that we see, Jay Gold, kind of this Falstaffian figure in a way, with his very long stringy hair and his weird suspenders, going around and would probably be able to throw down with any expert on rap and on 90s West Coast gangster rap today with just about anyone.
Of course, it's his food writing that really caught everybody's attention. When it comes to writing, define his style. What made him unique?
Well, extremely vivid, narrative-driven in the sense that he understood that food is an experience more than sort of a scientific collection of ingredients. And so he would engage the different aspects of the restaurant or food-going experience, everything from the entrance to the seating to the food to the vibe to the buzz, the sort of more amorphous and intangible ways in which we experience a restaurant or a new food cart. He did all of that very lovingly. Jonathan was not one who would want to write a negative review. He did work very hard for many years to maintain his anonymity. And after he was the subject of a documentary, he was unable to maintain that. And so then he just went on TV, you know, as much as he could. But here he was for many years, sort of very low pro, under the radar. A celebrity-driven city doesn't look like a celebrity by any means. And through these kinds of methods, I think he was taught us to always be as open-minded and generous as possible in the way that we approach food. That is to say, he also was able to do extremely high dining food reviewing and do it like a master. Even just last year, his 101 best restaurants list at the LA Times. He named this place Vespertine the number one restaurant, and he sort of talks about how it's the big elephant in the room to name this place that I would probably never be able to afford to go to.
Right.
But then by the end of it, he sort of convinces you to understand the beauty and, I guess, in a way, the glamour and sort of the high operatic art that is dining done at that extreme high caliber level.
Do you think that he maybe polarized the food scene and foodies in LA?
No, I think actually quite the contrary. Mm. I think he was able to really unify the different levels of foodies, I would say, that there are. I think that more than anything, he provided us an option to have this bridge and to always be open and to understand that food really is the culture that binds us all and that we can use it as a base to build sort of just a better place to live. And I would dare say that there's also, you know, before Bourdain, you know, Gold was doing this. And so I do hope that more people get to read him and get to experience and relive his legacy by trying to experience LA in the way that he did.
Jonathan Gold was the first food writer to win a Pulitzer Prize for criticism. And the way you're talking it, it strikes me that that could not have been just for his writing alone. He had a wider reach with what he did.
Exactly. I mean, I think the idea of criticism is one that has been reshaped a lot by the internet and the way that everyone has opinion instantly on everything. And I think what Jonathan was doing was telling us a story about something frequently that we would just have in front of our faces and that we suddenly had a new vision and a new way to appreciate and understand. And I will continue to eat my way through this town, hopefully as faithfully as Jay Gould did. And I hope that his memory and his legacy lives on for many years in this city.
Danielle Hernandez, the editor of LA Taco, thanks for telling us about your memories of Jonathan Gold and his legacy. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Street food, it's a thing, thanks in large part to Jonathan Gold. We leave you on that note today. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.